Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I am here with...
Holly Twyford.
And Gregory Linnington.
Who play the legendary George and Martha in Edward Albee's, the late Edward Albee's, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, now through February 19th at Ford's Theater. Thanks so much for coming in, guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
I just saw this thing on Saturday at Ford's, and I loved it. I'd only ever seen the movie with Liz Taylor and Richard Burton, but I'd never actually seen it live on stage. Man, it just moves. I mean, I know it's 3 hours in, you know, 1 hour chunks, but that sucker just moves, 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 and it's still relevant.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's scarily relevant.
It is.
55-year-old play, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about that a lot in rehearsal, actually, that it was, number one, written by this relatively young man at that period.
Right.
And yet the things that he touches on are so, still so applicable to our lives.
Sadly.
Yeah.
I mean, there's times where I don't even feel like I'm acting because I'm speaking his words, but they're certainly... some of my opinions as well.
Well, he was born in D.C., but this was his Broadway debut, the first one that got on Broadway, I believe.
I think so. Yeah,
think
Zeus
it was.
Story was off Broadway, I think, right. But this is the first Broadway.
I think
yeah,
Zeus Story was in Berlin or something weird Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, all right, before we start getting out on Albee too much and his life and career, let's pretend some of our listeners that are hearing this have never seen it. Give them the basic plot rundown.
It's about four people in a home. Having a party.
I'm gonna go a little further and say that it's about a very particular night in George and Martha's home when a lot of sort of earth-shattering understandings and long-held illusions and beliefs are shattered, partly because of their two young guests, and partly in some ways the guests are catalysts, in some ways they're sort of an audience for George and Martha's crazy fun and games.
Explain who George and Martha are.
George is a history professor at a small liberal arts college. And Martha is...
an associate professor.
An associate, thank you. Associate.
An associate professor's salary.
exactly.
And Martha is his wife and also the daughter of the president of the college.
Right.
So.
Yes. And the two guests you have over?
A young, new associate professor. He's about 20 years my junior, and he has the exact same job that I do, sadly, and his young... pretty wife.
Who's a mousy little thing without any hips.
Without any hips.
A little ditzy, too, and can't hold her liquor really well.
As it turns out.
Whereas you guys just pour it down the hatch. Okay.
I don't know. I think, honey, there's a lot more going on with honey than meets the eye.
Absolutely.
I think that applies to the entire play. There's a lot going on.
That's true.
In fact, that's like the whole theme. Take us into, obviously the title is a play on the, you know, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf and Virginia Woolf combined together, and your character sings it at a party, and it rears its head throughout the play, including the final line. But go sort of into the symbolism of the title and how it works in, because there's a lot to do without spoiling the reveal, but there's a lot of secrets and illusion versus reality, and sort of go into the symbolism of the title.
He apparently had seen this as a piece of graffiti on a wall, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and then wrote it down in a notebook. It wasn't the original title of the play.
Thank God he didn't call the play For a Good Time Call.
555.
Luckily, he called.
This is Simon and Garfunkel. The words of the prophets are written on the subway wall.
Sometimes
the graffiti works out.
That's right.
Yeah.
But you've thought about this a lot because you've done a lot of reading of Woolf, of Virginia Woolf.
So, right. So I didn't understand this until I was talking to a friend of mine who's a very, very smart professor at a college. And she was talking about Virginia Woolf and her feelings about and writings about illusion. And how anti-illusion she was. And in fact, my script, I've sort of cut out all of these quotations of various books of hers about illusion and that we need to live in reality and we need to, you know. So ultimately, that's what Martha's afraid of. Mm-hmm. Because really, for the past 23 years, for their entire marriage, she's been living in a little bit of a...
make-believe.
A little bit of a make-believe. Yeah, exactly.
A hugely crafted, intricate illusion that has affected our marriage and has affected our relationship and...
That she can't seem to live without, I think. Mm. I think so. That's the.
But you're sort of you're a little complicit in it with her because towards the end it's like, totally, why did you have to do that? But it's almost like you have your own mental understanding in constructing this world. But what's George's part in keeping that illusion alive? You think?
I think that it's surprising because George I feel like comes across as the weaker of the two. I think as you look at the piece and then. Perhaps it's revealed that we're much more equally matched throughout the course of the play,
or even there's a switch.
A switch,
I would even say maybe. He's
absolutely complicit. He's absolutely complicit, and but with the understanding that it's always something that is intensely, intensely private. Yeah. This illusion that we're living in. As are many of the illusions that all of us are living in. They tend to be intensely private. The things that happen inside of a marriage, of course, are meant to happen only for those two people.
Right.
And when some of those things are revealed to other people, intense, as I say, acute embarrassment can occur.
Absolutely. Explain how sort of, because we're talking about sort of the illusion and the secret that they both hold, without trying to spoil it, but I can always cut it out if we do. explain how it's almost a different experience, shocking, sarcastic, smart-ass quips the first time you're watching it, and you're just enjoying these guys go at it and, hold things over each other's head, versus having already seen and being familiar with the play once and knowing the secret, how Albie geniusly puts in little breadcrumbs. We were talking about one giant flop and all these little cues that... If you're an engaged viewer, this is the best kind of plays where you're almost trying to keep up with the director. But explain how he foreshadows it and puts those brilliant breadcrumbs.
He's incredibly, and very much a genius. I mean, we always talk about the early versions of the play where there were a lot more. Where Hansel and Gretel could absolutely find their way home.
There weren't just breadcrumbs.
No,
it was
the rocks that
something. I don't know.
Did he change it because he thought it was too overt and wanted to?
I don't know. I mean,
we don't know the answer to that, but we sort of think so.
Right.
I mean, he just...
There are a lot of little clues. It feels like a much more refined piece. This is the 2005 revised edition that we're doing. And it's a very, very different play than the original. There are no tells, as opposed to the film where there's a tell very early on.
Right. Right off
Mike Nichols, I think it was film debut.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
That's
year before The Graduate.
That's right. Yep. That's exactly right. And... Yeah, they. I don't understand necessarily the reasons for. I think that Albie is supposed that we are a more intelligent audience. I think as he got older, this is an idea that I have. That as he got older, that we could follow along and maybe we'd pick up those things and maybe we wouldn't. They're not essential,
right?
But he gives they're very few. It feels very Spartan.
But
I
think also what's fun, Jason, you're talking about somebody who knows the story.
Yeah,
and who. They're not going to be surprised. And I think somehow he is able to still surprise you, to draw you in fun and games. We forgot until our first audience how funny this play is.
My God.
This play is so funny.
How can something be so hilarious and so,
so
deep
dark.
And dark?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's why it's one of the greatest plays ever. Yeah. Maybe the greatest.
And I think that he does, it's very tricky how he does that.
So if our listeners are hearing this and they're like, man, that sounds heavy, go into that a little more of how it's going to hit you on all levels. You're going to laugh so hard it hurts your belly and it's going to hit you in the gut emotionally too.
Yeah. I think it's a way of opening us up. Yeah. I mean, I always feel very exposed as an audience member when I've been laughing and that allows that knife just to slide in under the ribs and get you.
Yeah.
But I think it's a riot.
They're just, I mean, he's a great comic writer. There's some just great one-liners and they're usually zings.
Yep.
more often than not.
Can you give us a teaser of them? I don't want to ruin it for people, though. What's it? What's
the
one?
The only one I can think of is one of yours, which gets a huge, but I don't want to give it away.
Yeah, let's not give it away. Yeah, maybe we shouldn't give them away. We're not going to give away. You got to come. Trust us. It's hilarious. I guess we got to talk about it more generally than specific zingers. Talk about each of their characters' comedic sensibilities. Let's talk about that. Because I honestly think both of them, I think, sort of shaped how our comedies worked over the years as well.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's that level of sarcasm. I mean, they're both the most brilliant, two most brilliant people, I think, that have ever been put on a page. I've never played anybody as smart or as
quick.
What is your
line to Nick about taking our wits for a walk or something like that?
We're simply walking what's left of our wits.
I think is so great. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too. I don't know whether that's that sort of, it's not insult comedy, but it's a sort of a version of it that is, I think, very American.
Yep. Yeah. Rickles, Don. I think of Don Rickles all the time.
And,
with
and the banter that they have is so illustrative of their marriage.
Right.
You know, it's so clear they've been together for 23 years, playing these, you know, having these sort of vocal sparring matches.
And you know all the dirt on each
and
other.
Exactly. So. You know exactly where to go, and you also know when to lay off.
Right.
Although that doesn't happen, very often on this particular
night.
How
many times in the play do you say, well, let's not go there?
I know.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, Jason. I mean, we do, in our heads, I think, a lot. Say, am I going to rise to that?
Yeah.
No, I'm not. Could you go get me a drink, please?
It goes straight down to grammar. I mean, something as base as somebody missing a, I mean, I think about the Ben thing. You say, I've been to, you know, you say, when you say, instead of saying, I've been to college, she says, I've been to college. And I pick up on that. Martha, been to college, you know, that we don't let anyone, we don't let us off. We're relentless about
it. I've got the ice. Gotten.
Gotten, right.
Yeah.
She's married to Joseph Cotton or something. Somebody.
Someone. Right, somebody, right.
Relentlessly. I mean, it's like they're parenting each other all the time too. That's one very interesting thing about the relationship is that they go back and forth between lovers and best friends and mother and father and there's a constant shifting with that, shifting.
Soulmate, enemy.
War. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's
absolutely.
Great. We've been talking a lot about how, you know, Albie's insult dialogue back and forth, but you alluded to it earlier with Fun and Games, but explain to our audiences how it's sort of that three acts with two intermissions and how each act is contained in a cute little title there too.
Right.
Originally the title of the play was The Exorcism.
nice and light.
And,
the power of Albie compels you.
And then, maybe that's when he came upon that in the bathroom wall or
maybe,
something.
Maybe, yeah,
know.
Yeah. Or they thought, we're not going to sell any tickets to this damn thing.
If you look at a script, and it, you know, it's three acts, and the first act is titled Fun and Games, and then the second act is titled Walpurgisnacht, and then the
which is night?
It's a night. It's a night when the witches go up on the mountain and they sort of mess around with things.
Gotcha.
And they, so there's a lot of creepy magic going on.
Right. And the temptations coming out a little
bit.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And then the third act is called The Exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
When finally everything is resolved. Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Now, within the titles that appear in the pages of the script, but in the dialogue, you guys have some interesting little phrases for each segment too, don't you? You say we've already played this, now we're going to play this, and then
humiliate the host and get the guests,
right?
And,
right.
And then something a little more risque for air.
Yeah.
Hump the host.
Hump
is
the
that
hostess.
It?
Hostess. Yeah. Yeah.
But it kind of plays out along those lines in a way.
As we set it up, it's true.
It's amazing. It really is.
I mean, games, I think, is a huge theme in the play.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the first act, as I said, is called Fun and Games, but it And later on in the in the third act, I say something about George being able to keep up with the games that we play, even as I change the rules constantly. And that is, I think it's an important sort of aspect. And it, you know, it also in a way speaks to illusion and speaks to not, you know, not being in real life. Well, it's just a game. If we, we're just playing a game. But of course, there are games that are rooted in rather ugly realities.
And I think about rules as well, and the way that children adhere so strictly to rules in games, and how it's
right. What's fair and
what's
not fair?
Who's cheating?
Yeah,
you know, kids are really, really focused on those things, and where you think that there are no rules in this relationship, and it's kind of this no holds barred, people just beating the hell out of each other all the time. It's not true. There are, in fact, rules of the game that
one very big rule.
Right. And when transgressed, then other games need to be played.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I need to change. If you're changing the rules, if she's changing the rules that way, then he needs to find a new way to play.
Yeah.
Explain why. I mean, we've kind of alluded to it a little bit, but explain how the time period of the early 60s is ripe for this study of illusion versus reality. It's sort of this, you know, when you look back in hindsight, it's everyone thinks the glorious, you know, white picket fence, middle America post-war. But as we've seen over and over again with ordinary people
line
or
about
Blue
Make America
Velvet
great
or American
again
Beauty,
here,
whatever, there's all these kinds of examples. But this is the ultimate, and he's writing in the time as opposed to those that are looking back on it, which is why he's so ahead of his time. But talk about why that period is so ripe to dig under the underbelly of Americana.
It's right before the Beatles. It's right before Kennedy was killed. Right. I mean, it's a very...
And before the Vietnam War. After World War II.
Right.
And the Korean War.
It's like that Mad Men era. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And there's something about it has a kind of 50s mentality in a way, as I think you do, as you encroach into a new decade, you're still holding on to vestiges of the old, right? It feels like the ideal would be these people are fine, right? And the younger couple are fine.
College jobs, everything's great.
Right. Why would they might be a little bit liberal, or they might drink a little bit too much, but you know, who doesn't, right? I mean, that's the way. But then as more of the onion is peeled, you sort of get down to
I mean, it's funny. We were just talking, I think this speaks directly to that. We were just talking about the set. Mm-hmm. Our brilliant set designer,
Megan Rahm,
and her, you see a house and it's as though the house has been cut in half. So you see the insides of the walls and you see the insulation and you
the
see
the wiring and
cutaway stuff. And
like a cross section. Kind
of. That's right. And it's as though, you know, on the outside, the house looks like any normal house and everything's fine. But you cut into it, and there's this underbelly, this under-rumbling, Aaron Posner, our director, would say, of what is really going on. And I mean, it was certainly true of that time, but really it's true for any time, I think. You know, when we observe other people or other families, and we say, I know you of old, but really you don't. Really, you don't know what's going on.
I find the piece oddly comforting in that. I think my family's messed up. We're all messed up.
Yeah.
And that's that. And it's
Thanksgiving dinner is going to sound like a walk in the park compared to this.
Walk in the park. Yeah.
Exactly.
But you mentioned you mentioned sort of how it's this cross section of a home, but and also you mentioned the director. Explain how working with him and mostly just sort of like how you block everything and how the house almost becomes a spatial signifier of things are going on. I mean, you have the stairs where, you know, going up, we know what happens up there. You have them constantly going into the bathroom because honey can't hold her liquor. But then you have the couch where you come sit by me. There's a little of that going on. You have the bar where you go to get more fuel for your fire.
That's right.
But explain, how do you guys work on how you're going to use the space with the director? Because some of that's pretty genius how you weave it in.
I would agree. Working with Aaron first of all, it's a dream working with the guy. He's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened to use that overworn phrase organically. I mean, that's right. I mean, it didn't,
I'm sure that phrase came up organically at some point.
It did.
But it's a little cliche now. But yeah, I know what you mean.
It happens very naturally. I guess naturally is what I really mean. It felt, he never really, I don't think a piece of blocking was imposed on any of us. Maybe cheat out so we can see you.
Right.
But
so you two worked that out sort of in rehearsal? You sort of
the four
added
of,
to
I
that?
Mean, very much or the four, four
I mean,
of us, yeah.
The beauty of working with Aaron Posner, and in my belief, the great directors, are that they know how to speak to actors very well. Mm-hmm. And the thing that a director should continue to say to an actor all the time is, okay, but what do you want? What is your intention? What is your objective? You know, there's 5 million ways to say it. What is your verb? and Aaron kept asking that. And that's how you tell a good story is, you know, even if what you want is just to have a drink to survive the next 2 minutes, that's an objective. That's a, you know, that's an intention. And so that's really how blocking comes about, in my opinion. You know, you want to escape, go up to the bar.
Mm-hmm.
You want to, you know, I mean, there. You want to attack, cross over to that and talk to his face.
Yeah.
And he was relentless in his pursuit of that truth.
Yeah.
Absolutely relentless.
Yeah.
And would dog us moment to moment. It, you know, I could come up with 1,000 different things that I was doing, but then he would say, well, what do you want? What is it you're really trying to do?
Yeah.
And it was a wake-up call.
Yes, it is, really.
Indeed.
Well,
yes,
because,
indeed.
I mean, there are a lot of directors that just don't speak that way.
That's right.
And that's fine if you know how to do your job and, you know.
Sure.
But
if there's any young director, or, you know, stage or film or whatever directors coming up, what would be your advice then in how to work with the actors? Is it finding the moments of intention at each moment of the piece, or?
You have an intention, and then you have the tactics that are used to achieve that intention, right?
Right.
So I was I could speak to a very large idea, and I could speak to very small ideas, but he was talking about the middle ground, right? What are you doing? Not necessarily moment to moment, but larger arc. So if you're looking, he said it's the difference between good acting and great acting, right? Is a kind of visibility of intention. That's much more, I think, theater than it is film.
Right.
Film, you can read eyes and just a twitch or a tightening of the lips, and that gives you a different
story. 'Cause
the
camera's right there.
Yeah, that's right. But with stage, you've got to kind of show people things in a way.
And I think you know that comes. From this is gonna sound crazy.
Oh, let's go there.
it comes from real life.
Right.
I mean, that's real life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
We have intentions in our life. We don't walk around and say, now I'm going to, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But we do. No matter what we're saying, we're teaching or we're attacking or we're seducing or we're whatever.
I've got to get to that. I got to get a cup of coffee. I got to start working in 15 minutes. I got to get the cup of coffee. You know, that's an intention.
That was before you guys walked in here. That's exactly what my intention was.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
But it's, you know, those are the things. I mean, I think one of the things that Aaron does, which is so remarkable, is he reminds us that we are first and foremost holding up a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
To actual real humanity.
There's a line in the playbill that I remember reading.
Have you
Here
read
we go.
The playbill? I haven't read the playbill.
I haven't looked at it yet.
They quote Albie once said, "I like to hold a mirror up to people and say, hey, this is the way you behave. This is who you are. If you don't like what you see, maybe you should change."
Yeah.
So there's your mirror. It's
true.
Yeah,
there's my mirror.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's true. And you know, to just, we do, we forget, actors forget. And you have to go back and say, well, okay, wait a minute. So what if this is actually happening to you? It's one of his favorite phrases.
Actually.
Oh, I love it. The two actually's really.
Yeah.
It's helpful.
Yeah.
It's helpful.
There's a difference. There's a difference between the one actually and the two actually.
It's true, actually.
He's going to laugh when he hears this.
When you get the three actually's, watch out.
Yes, but, you've never been to three actually's.
Seriously.
That sounds frightening.
Well, that's what we're doing for the rest of the interview. Damn it. Three actually's. No, we've gotten so far in. Danny and Maggie,
yeah.
Nick and Honey.
Oh,
I mean, so we've talked about Nick and Honey, obviously, but talk about working with them because, you know, it's really a four-person thing. You guys are all working on this. You mentioned blocking it out together with them.
It's a quartet. It's a quartet.
They're the bomb.
Yeah. They are incredible.
Yeah.
Literally.
Incredible. I mean,
in the play.
They are, yeah.
You know, I was saying the other day, when I'm sitting on stage, I can look around and any of those three faces that I look at are right in the story with me. They're totally engaged. And that does not always happen.
Maggie's sort of terrifying in as much as we'll be talking and doing notes, and then a second later we would work and look into her eyes and she would look drunk instantly. I'm talking about,
right, because she's processing a note or something and she's like, well, what was it?
But just behind her eyes. And so I have a hard time sometimes not laughing at her on stage because I'm so deeply in her belief, right, with her. It's unreal. It's really
unreal.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And all of the nuances I feel like Danny has added to, I think I think it's actually the most, and Aaron and I have talked about this, I mean, we talked about it, but I think Nick is the most difficult track to kind of figure out.
You think that's the hardest part to play?
I do.
It's true.
In terms of just his through line, why is he staying? Why, there's a lot of justification that he's got to give it. And I really think Danny has fleshed out this role in an amazing way.
Oh my gosh.
Way.
Does
Absolutely.
It have to do with the fact that you know, you're the daughter of the university president? Is that his motivation, you think?
I mean, I think if you ask, I mean, that's a question for him because we did talk about it in rehearsal, but ultimately he had to figure out why.
Yeah.
You know, that's not my problem. Why he's staying.
Enough to worry about.
But he, I mean, there's a bunch of different reasons why.
Yeah.
And he had to figure that out because there's a lot of places where he could say, you know what?
Yeah.
That's it.
You all are crazy.
Yeah.
I am out of here.
Yeah.
And he doesn't.
Yeah.
He doesn't. And sometimes he's stopped. Sometimes George says, no,
right,
you can't leave now.
He's ready for to go to the door at
some point. Yeah. But a lot of it's very interesting. And I agree. I think that's a, you know,
extremely
on
difficult
the,
track.
You know, at first it's like, you know, smart, successful jock, you know,
right,
in new job, up and coming, blah, blah, blah.
Mr. Everything.
All, right.
Yeah. And there is, talk about an underbelly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot more going on.
And George is so crafty in the way that he elicits a kind of trust that then leads him to reveal a lot more than he should to anybody like George, because when he's got the goods, he's going to use the
you
goods.
You are in trouble.
Yeah.
Sneaky little devil, how you get that.
He is
you
very
you win him over a little. And then how about for you, though? What is it you think that snaps, that you say it snaps at the party when, you know, when you're looking over at him and he's, you know, off to the side? Why do you choose this night? This is where the Band-Aid comes off.
You know, I don't think I necessarily choose that tonight's the night that the Band-Aid comes off.
Okay.
I think that it is much more of a sort of developing night. Something happened at that party, and I don't think she puts it into words until later.
Mm.
And what I mean is that that part of the illusion of
just the couple.
Of the couple is broken. It broke.
Yeah.
I have seen clear as day something that I've known for years and years, and that is, I don't want to say this
right here.
And that is that he's never going to be what I, what I want him to be. And it's not only what I want him to be, it's what I want him to be for him, which I think is the most important nuance.
Yeah, you say as much in the show. That's actually in the text. I mean, you say
I say it several times.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important. That I see that and I say, okay, you have let yourself down completely, and that's how you've let me down.
Yeah,
and that's the. It was like. Yeah, it was like a crack in the universe, sort of, that happens.
A moment of clarity that you'd not had before, right?
Yeah.
She'd suspected for a while, and there's the example right in front of her.
Yeah.
To confirm.
Or
it.
or I knew it all along somehow. And
deluding yourself or something. Yeah.
And why do I choose to talk about it that night is because it's another really big weapon that I can use.
Do you invite the couple over? Do they say the backstory? She invites them.
Right. It's after 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm ready to go to sleep. I was probably ready to leave the party about 3 hours ago.
Every time there's a new professor at the school, my dad says, you know, go, you know, make sure they feel welcome.
Yeah. And it turns into musical beds.
And so,
perhaps.
As they say in the play.
I was going to say that's another supposition is that people are, you know, that they're dealing with these kinds of infidelities and, oh, it was the 60s and it was different. And I don't know about that because I don't know anyone that's ever been necessarily pleased by an infidelity outside of those things in any age, I don't know.
Yeah.
Kind of a dead end there. But anyway, it's
maybe a little more hidden back then or something.
Perhaps.
So that's sort of the motivation she brings. And she's like, all right, tonight's the night after she sees that. But what do you think I don't want to say yours is a reaction to that, but what is your driving force to keep the night?
I think that there is a reaction to it. I always think of intentions as being something you can state very clearly. Like, I am cold, so I want to shut the window. Right. You know, the things like that.
Right.
I want, you know, I want my wife back. Those are very easy things to understand. I think that when they first come home, he wants to go to bed. I think that is as plain as that. Then these guests show up, right? So then it's perhaps to have some fun with them in his own sort of twisted way.
We're gonna do this at 2 a.m. Let's have fun with it. Yeah.
And then there's things that are revealed. Yeah.
At some point he realizes something's different.
Something tonight is different.
Yeah. Where do you think that moment is? Is it Act 1?
Exactly where it is.
Oh, you do?
Exactly where it is. Oh yeah.
Are you able to tell us?
I am not.
Don't tell me.
I am not going to tell you.
But in your mind, you know it on stage.
It's crystal clear, and for me, it's crystal clear in the text. There's a lot of. I mean, he's put so much of what it is that we're doing. I was such a pedant during rehearsal, and Holly and I think the rest of the cast and certainly the director wanted to string me up because I would always go back to the text as opposed to going to the people who are in the room with me, which comes from being a Shakespeareophile and working classical theater for too long.
You're not telling the whole story.
What am I not telling?
You didn't go to the, quote, text. Unquote.
I went to the stage direction.
That's correct. Yes.
That was a real George and Martha moment. Right there.
I've
been going to the text.
I admitted it and acquiesced as opposed to attacked back. Yeah. So we're a little bit more refined, I feel like, than they are. But no, I saw so much in the original reading of it that was, if you just read this play on the page, I mean, it is, as you said, it's wildly funny just to read it off the page. But he's also put in a lot of, I think of them as clues. Other actors, you know, they want to cross out all of the stage directions. I found them to be very, very helpful and could quote them scripture and verse, to the director, and would ad infinitum
until
remains my Bible and will be for another couple of weeks. Yeah, and I clung to those things, and when we would meet in the middle, and when I would release some of my notions about these things, then Holly and I, and I feel like would really start to intersect. Nice. We would really begin to connect in ways that I think transcended what he originally wrote, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest problem with stage directions in general is that they are qualitative.
Right.
And they're not intention-based.
Right. Mm-hmm. And therefore limited.
Unless it says, she attacks him, or, you know, something like that. And so that's not helpful.
He gives some of them like one he'll give is driving. And I really love that stage direction because not only is he referring to pace, but he's also referring to intention in my mind.
Yeah.
I think about driving horses, whipping somebody into shape. Right. And that's a great verb to play on stage.
Yeah,
that's wonderful.
Absolutely.
Sadly, they're not all. They're not all like that.
Right? Like
there's a lot of L-Y words, which are very difficult to play on stage.
Confusingly. Awesome. What else have you? Oh, when did you guys see the movie? Talk about Liz Taylor and Richard Burton, because that's how a lot of us think of this.
Or yeah, another version. Have you seen this play performed? Did you see?
I've seen it performed many, many, many years ago.
Who did you see do it?
At Everyman Theater.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
And I haven't seen it since. And I don't think that I've ever seen
the film.
The whole film. Wow. I've seen clips of it.
Oh, we should watch
but
it.
But I don't think
when
we're
done. Maybe when it's
done,
over.
We're done. Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't affect the performance.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want to. We did. There is a recording on YouTube. The original Broadway cast recording.
And
the
gal who played.
The gal who played Honey.
Arthur Hill. Yeah.
Melinda Dillon.
Melinda Dillon, yeah.
Who my mother wrote a story about for a magazine.
What?
I just found this out. What? About Melinda Dillon
is that
being
the same
a,
Melinda
being
Dillon?
Rising, yes.
Same
a rising
one that we know from all the other movies.
From film and television.
Actress.
Yes, yeah.
So anyway, so she put these things on YouTube and you can listen to the entire play.
Wow.
With Uta Hagen and Arthur Hill.
I can't remember
and,
who played next. I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
We're very sorry.
Wonderful, wonderful actor. and that was really interesting. And at first, there were moments when I would hear Uta Hagen do something in a certain way, and I would think, wait, that's not at all how I'm doing
right,
it.
Right.
It's different. It is. It's 55 years later.
This is an this production feels I feel like immediate. It does. It feels like something staged this year.
Yeah.
A little bit of last year, but very very much staged this year for a contemporary audience. And that does feel like a time capsule.
I mean,
or something.
Acting styles have
dramatically changed.
Have changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, and my experience with it. I've seen the film. I became obsessed with watching all of Nichols' films and. This was, of course, number one on the list, and amazing performances, of course, from the entire cast in that film. But I also saw a production at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, where I worked for many years, and that was, again, another brutal experience. I think that was before this revised version. So there are whole scenes that have been excised, and as we say, those little Easter eggs or breadcrumbs along the way, they were all there. So I saw that intact version, the original play. And that was got to be at least 15 years ago, I think. So interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. But yeah, those are my only two experiences with the piece.
And now both Nichols and Albee have passed away in recent years. Talk about Albee's legacy.
My God.
Turner was in here in your chair.
Wow. Right.
right after it happened. And she said, because she, I think, had done Virginia Woolf once.
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, but so we kind of got her immediate reaction, but just, now that a couple of, months have passed.
Every Mamet, Sorkin, any of these very muscular sort of male writers, I feel like owe so much to him. He comes from, of course, a classical background, but also this more Dadaist, kind of wackier background, because he was friends with Beckett, and I feel like there's exchanges in our play that could have come straight out of Shakespeare, they could have come straight out of Beckett, that have almost nothing on top of them. I did not know how good this play was. And even I reread it, I didn't know how good it was. And then rereading it and over and over again for the past, because we were cast a year ago in the roles, over the past year, I have such an intense level of respect for the mastery. I feel like we're
the
all
The fact
indebted
that we continue to... discover new layers.
Like yesterday, I'll go through the script again today and I will find new things. There's always new things.
Jason, to get back to sort of his legacy, all I can do is be the most honest, truthful Martha and honor that story. And it sounds like we're sort of doing it. I mean, what people... Huh. A friend of mine came and saw the show the other night, and then she was back at my house later on, and she was standing there with this sort of odd expression, and I said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "I'm great." She said, "I feel like energized and rejuvenated," and I'm thinking, "Wow, you just saw a 3-hour play that, you know, has some very sort of horrific moments. Right. And she said, but it was so, it was such an incredible piece of theater.
And
it did, and it did what theater is supposed to do. Theater is supposed to take us on the journeys that we sometimes can't do in real life. And that catharsis, I think, is something. And boy, could he write that. Holy moly. I mean, they're just, you know, they're just not, there's some really great playwrights out there. To take somebody on a roller coaster like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you come and see us, you will forget about your troubles and get involved in ours.
In our troubles.
Absolutely. Come get involved in something
else. I promise you'll forget about a lot of things. But,
no, but it's interesting when you said that, like, you had forgotten and were amazed at how great it was once you read it in. Because obviously it sits out there in the pantheon of the great plays. It, it's one of the, you know, instantly comes to mind. But that's what hit me so hard about it. Because I, you know, I'm like, all right, this is the classic one I've seen, you know, the movie. You know. But I'm like, all right, let's go check it out. And then you literally sit there and you marvel at, really, how great it is every second along the way. I was blown away, so thanks for doing it, first of all.
Thank you so much,
and thank you, Fords, and thank you, Aaron. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Before we go, tell me about yourselves. Where did you grow up? How'd you get into acting?
Oh my lord, you go first.
I was raised a little bit in New York, and then was raised in LA, and did a lot of theater growing up from the time I was seven, 8 years old. Spent a lot of time trying to figure out if basketball or football or baseball or any of those things. And my mother kept pushing me into rooms and onto, you know, roller skating rinks. And she pushed me one last time into a room where I did theater for the very first time. It was the last push she ever had to give me, and that was I was about 8 years old.
She kept pushing.
She was driving.
She was driving me, exactly. Try this. And this is the last thing that I ever really needed to try. Something I always knew I wanted to do. And I grew up in Southern California doing a lot of theater. And then
where in California?
In LA. Well, okay. Valencia, just north of Santa Clarita Valley. Yeah. And then went to a great high school for theater, and did a little bit of actor training after that, and then just started working. I moved to Prague. I lived in Prague off and on for 5 years and did a lot of English language theater there. Wow. And then I went to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, where I worked for 12 years and did mostly classical and some brand new plays, but mostly classical work. Yeah. So, and about 2 years ago, I moved to D.C. and found this amazing theater community.
Saw the light and came to D.C.
I know, seriously.
It is a crazy,
it's
amazing
a phenomenal theater community. I mean, I think about just walking into auditions when I was in Los Angeles, walking into auditions where it's cold and people are trying to focus on themselves and trying to get the job. And here, everyone is just, from the very first audition when nobody knew me, people were so welcoming. When did you get here? Oh, do you want to meet this person? Oh, you need this email contact and you should join this Facebook group. And all of these things are really, it's very, very wide open. There's a lot of room here, it feels like, for a lot of different people to work. And
it's a legitimate community.
It's a legitimate community that supports each other. Mm-hmm. And we're not afraid to express it. I think about seeing other people's work and I gush when it's fantastic, I absolutely let them know. And that isn't always the
case.
When
it's terrible,
we just keep very quiet. That's the thing. I don't think you really see a lot of terrible is. I don't know that. I haven't seen a lot of terrible. So.
Yeah.
No, there's not a lot.
Not yet, at least. I've only been here a few years.
There's not a lot of terrible.
The bumper sticker. DC theater. There's not a lot of terrible.
I mean, it's true. There really isn't. A lot of terror. I can't remember the last terrible
play. No.
Yeah.
Well, because you got Ford, you got Arena, you got Kennedy Center. I mean, it's
Shakespeare Theater. Studio Woolley. Yeah. The list goes on.
National
Warner.
On and on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Rorschach, Keegan. Yeah. You know,
Signature.
All kinds
of stuff. Holly, where did you grow up and how did you get into all that? Why did you?
Local girl makes good.
What's Honey's line?
When is your son?
Where are you? I was born
In a van down by the river.
I was born on a September night. I was born at Sibley, and I grew up in Great Falls, Virginia, and did theater in high school, and I guess I did little theater. I guess my first show was in fourth grade. There was a play. I can't remember what it was called.
We started like the same time. We started
and
little
we
kids.
Did.
That's so great.
And then I went away to Boston University to their School of Theater Arts. At the time, it was called SFA. And I did that, and I had a sort of, this is going to sound cheesy, but I had sort of an epiphany when I was a freshman where I thought, oh, good Lord, there's nothing else I want to do. That's a problem.
It's a solution, and, actually.
Well, you know, I mean, I do. I think about it. It's not very easy. It's not easy to go from these very emotional jobs where you're with these people for 2 months, day in and day out, over and over again. It's not easy to be... you know, not get a role because you're too old or too young or right. too whatever. And not take that personally. I mean, it's difficult. Why would one choose this? So in some ways I feel like it chose me. I feel like I don't have a choice. And now I don't have any other yeah. marketable skills. So,
sorry, really we're too old to learn anything.
I could maybe sling some gin. But so I was at BU and I was there for 2 years, and then I was cut from the acting program, and so I went into this other program. It was called Theater Studies, which turned out to be kind of a great program, and. Because it hadn't been very established, and so we kind of created our own sort of thing. So I walked out of BU with a rather extensive technical resume. So my first audition in D.C. for the wonderful Jerry Manning, who at the time was the casting director at Arena, but later on was artistic director for Seattle Rep and sadly passed away. But he was directing a play, and I went in for the play, and he said, I'm not going to use you in the play, but do you do wigs? and I said, yes, I do. I had had some wig experience in a show that I had done. And so my first professional job in Washington Theater was as the wig mistress at Arena Stage for a production of Pygmalion. Oh. And I met the most wonderful people doing that play, Tana Hicken and Richard Bauer and Terry Currier and old school Arena Stage folks and newer folks, Jennifer Mendenhall. That was the first time I met her and doing wigs. Yeah. Tammy Grimes was in that play and she was a trip.
came to DC to join the wig party.
Yeah. Like so, and then I mean, really it was, you know, Jennifer introduced me around. Again, it was a community, you know, and Jennifer introduced me to a couple people. And the next thing I knew, I was doing a play called Her Aching Heart with a theater company called Consenting Adults Theater Company. And it was a great play by Bryony Lavery. And it was a blast. And that was my first professional show.
Wow.
So.
And here we are.
And I've been very lucky.
And I would be remiss if we didn't mention the fact that we're working together again, actually. We're working together at a theater called Roundhouse Theater in Bethesda. Yeah. And we're doing another play, actually, with Aaron, actually.
So what is this play?
This is a play called Or. It's a new play.
O-R?
O-A-R. Okay. O-R, yeah, exactly. And it's a three-hander, so I play a bunch of roles, and Aaron Weaver plays a bunch of roles, and you just play one role.
I play one role.
You play one role. Yeah. And but Aaron Posner. So if you like this combination of people, come and see us again. We're doing another play together. So yeah, it's great. It's really
awesome.
Great.
Speaking of like sort of putting this role down in a couple of weeks and moving on to the next thing. What do you think you'll sort of carry with you from George and Martha? Not necessarily to your next character, because I'm sure there's a reset you do mentally, but, you know, just into your own life. Like, how do you think playing these people have sort of touched and changed your own look at the world?
It's a super intense journey. It has been a super intense build of this piece. I mean, I feel like we had sort of oddly enough time, but that was because Holly and I did what I call pre-hearsal, and Danny and Maggie joined us as well, where we rehearsed. We started rehearsing a month before.
Mm-hmm.
Our first rehearsal. So Holly,
my living room.
In Holly's living room. Oh, and so we would go.
Is that also cut in half down the walls? Or
cut in half. It's odd row house. Yeah.
we started that. And having that really, really helped. There are certain things that I feel like we established.
We did it. I mean, let's be honest. We did it because we were terrified.
We were terrified. Line load alone.
The lines and,
But that amount of pre-hearsal, that amount of preparation proved invaluable, and I don't think we would have. I mean, Aaron said, "Imagine if you guys were normal and you were trying to do this, you know, trying to learn these lines."
Having a hard time imagining.
Yeah, he was pretty psyched.
He was. Oh, wow. I mean, because all of the, you know, I have larger speeches that are my responsibility to learn. They're not on anybody else's shoulders to learn, so I learned them all by myself, and never spent really any time trying to learn them in the room with people, which I think saves a lot of time.
Yeah.
So that amount of preparation, but also there's a certain level of confidence that comes, I feel like, from playing something so large and having it, quote unquote, in hand. I will never have this thing in hand. It is far too unwieldy, a crazy wild gelding to be riding, to actually feel like you own it ever. I don't know that we own it, but we do it. We say about 90% of the lines in order every time we do it. Respect, Mr. Albee.
A friend of mine asked the other night whether she's like, did you make any mistakes?
Yeah, we make mistakes every night.
Yeah, I made mistakes.
We make mistakes every night.
We wouldn't know it. You guys just remember it perfectly.
Bless you. So yeah, but that level of confidence has led itself to, I feel like, you always want to tackle something that's going to, you know, really scare the crap out of you. And this really scared me. And to have even accomplished an iota of it is really, I feel like, a major accomplishment.
But are you going to walk away with any of George's attributes, do you think?
God, if I was reading at 4 a.m. I feel like I'm too much of an innocent in the world to be as crafty as this guy is. He's so bloody smart and witty. I don't know. I hope not in some ways. Maybe levels of compassion, because I do feel like he's got a lot of compassion and empathy as a person.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, it was interesting that I had an epiphany at one point where I realized that in many ways, I am more like George.
Yes.
Wow. And Gregory is more like Martha.
That's very true.
In our sort of emotional lives.
How so? That's fascinating.
Something irritates me, and I bite back, right? And you do
I was about to say. Oh, this is precisely.
There it is.
Precisely what I mean, because I was about to say we don't need to share that. And he practically
perfect. That's perfect.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect.
So
you got my side of it, which is exactly indicative.
And there it is.
Now, do you have something to take away, though, in terms of takeaway?
There must be something. I just don't know what it is. You know, I mean, it happens every time. There's there are glimpses in my everyday life right now that I can hear her when I say something.
Right.
And maybe she's taught me to express myself. I don't know.
And Aaron's ethic is another part of that. His adherence to truth, his adherence to him driving, constantly questioning intention, constantly questioning us. When the work is never ever done with him.
Yeah.
And I really do hope to take that into everything that I do. To constantly keep searching, never getting comfortable, never allowing it just to be one thing. That's that ethic. I really feel like that. I feel like I had an aspect of it, but it feels much more clearly. It feels much more refined now as a result of working, I feel like, with Aaron and the cast.
I have to say also that there is something. So Paul Tétrault,
Oh yeah,
knew Albee,
right?
And And there's something...
He runs for...
And there's something very... what's the word? Precious. Mm. Like, it means a lot to him.
Yes.
That we're doing this play. And I just, there's something very special about that sort of connection. Do you
That's
know what
right.
I mean?
Yep.
I think. So I feel sort of honored that he's trusted all of us.
That's very true.
You know?
It's an amazing honor. Because he was still alive and you mm-hmm. know, when we were all cast. Mm-hmm. And I think that our thought was that he was probably going to come and see it, you know, which was harrowing in and of itself. But he's we hope that he's
maybe
watching.
Maybe he has.
Exactly. But having that direct line to Paul in
made
that
it
way.
So special.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, you can take it back to Tetro and tell him that you did Albie justice. It's amazing. Everyone has to go see this play before it leaves. Whether you've seen it before or not, go see it. It is so awesome. And
Thank you so much.
To have you all in here. And this was a great, awesome conversation.
Thanks so much for having us.
And I hate to break it to you, this was all the pre-rehearsal, and now we're going to go another hour.
Now we're the real interview.
I'm all warmed up. Thank you very much, Jason. Thank you so much again.
It's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at Ford's Theater now through February 19th. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.